Lives matter, except the black ones.
You already know. We'll leave it at that. We got the brother Rock. Thank you so much for coming in.
You're already,
where can
man.
People follow you at on social media?
On Facebook, Mr. Rockness, if you're typing it in, or Rock of Helter Skelter. On Instagram is RocknessBCC. On Twitter is _Rockness_, because I'm trying to score. And yeah, that's about it. That's where I'm mostly at. So, yeah.
You already heard it, y'all. Appreciate y'all. This is Rebel Diaz Radio. We tuning out. Make sure to tune in every Wednesday, 10 p.m. to midnight. Hip-hop, culture, and politics with Rod Stars and my brother John Mega. Peace out, y'all. Let's go.
Monster.
The music. Okay, the Orange Man is our new president, but are you gonna spend inauguration night home alone and sad? No! Come to WBAI's Karaoke at the Commons. Sing a song of protest. Eve of Destruction might be appropriate. Sing a song of joy. Get down with Motown with me, Earth Mom, and my very special guest co-host, Randy Credico. And who knows, he may be bringing Bernie with him.
Join us for Karaoke at the Commons, a mini fundraiser for WBAI, on Friday, January 20th at 7 p.m.
Sing your heart out for WBAI.
Orchids bloom. My soul is fed by you. Fed by you. Listen to my heart speak. Bathe in the warmth of the morning sun. I'll wait for you.
I'll wait for you.
Bathe in the warmth of the morning sun.
My
welcome. You're listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. And we have a part two today of what we shared with you last week. And we also have a continued reading. We're going to have a bit of a discussion. And hopefully you will enjoy as much as we will this exchange. Good morning, Paulette.
Good morning, Catherine.
Good morning, Matt.
Good morning, Catherine.
And good morning to everyone out there, though probably most of you are thinking about good night. Technically, it is a good morning. And so, Paulette, tell us a little bit about the interview we're going to hear in a moment.
And so, for those of you who were listening last week, we gave you a fairly good taste of the music of this Cuban jazz musician, Mr. Pedrito Martinez. And as promised, this week we have an interview that I conducted with Pedrito just a couple of days ago about his art and the culture of Cuban jazz. And so this is the fruit of that conversation. So we're first going to play a bit of intro music, which is the Compa Galatano, and hope that you enjoy it.
Sin balas.
Welcome to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight on Ithaca Radio Network, WBAI in New York City. My name is Paulette Spencer, and tonight, in keeping with our work appreciating the Afro-Cuban music form, we are honored to have with us Afro-Cuban jazz musician, singer, composer, bata drummer, and conga performer Pedrito Martinez of the Pedrito Martinez Group. They will be performing throughout the month of January at several venues in New York City, which we will announce later on the program. To give you some background, Pedro Pablo Pedrito Martinez was born in Havana, Cuba, having settled in New York City in the fall of 1998. By 2000, he had been awarded the Theolonious Monk Award for Afro-Latin Hand Percussion and was featured in the documentary film Calle 54. Pedrito has performed or recorded with Angelique Kidjo, Wynton Marsalis, Paul Simon, Paquito de Rivera, Bruce Springsteen, and Sting, and has contributed as a percussionist and vocalist to over 50 albums. Mr. Martinez was also a founding member of the highly successful Afro-Cuban Afrobeat band Yerba Buena, with which he recorded 2 albums and toured the world. Pedrito's career as a leader began in 2005 with the formation in New York City of the Pedrito Martinez Group. The group's Grammy-nominated first album was released October 2013 and was chosen among NPR's favorite albums of 2013 and the Boston Globe Critics' Top 10 Albums of 2013. Havana Dreams, the group's second album and most recent album, was released in June 2016. Guests include Ruben Blades, Isaac Delgado, Wynton Marsalis, Decimer Bueno, Roman Diaz, Angelique Kidjo, and Tamari Diaz. Accolades for Havana Dreams include #1 Latin Jazz Album in NPR's Jazz Critics Top Jazz Albums for 2016, and being named among Boston Globe World Music Albums for 2016. Welcome to WBAI, Pedrito, and thank you for being with us this evening.
It's my honor. Thank you so much for the invitation. How are you doing?
I'm doing quite well. Thank you for taking the time to speak with us. I would like to start by discussing your very rich cultural musical history and how you bring that to the stage. We are celebrating Afro-Cuban musical culture in this program, and you have quite an extensive repertoire and knowledge of the musical history of the country where you were born. We are also celebrating your most recent album, Havana Dreams, which was released in June 2016 and has received high acclaim. You began performing at the age of 11 in Havana, and you grew musically in that country. Please tell us about your early musical development.
Well, I grew up in this very poor neighborhood in Havana, Cuba, right in the middle of Havana. The name of that neighborhood was is Cayo Hueso, and it was very rich and very, very beautiful and very important area where a lot of great rumberos, musicians, and folklore players grew up. So I was so lucky that I born and raised, and I that are born and raised in that area, so right in the middle of Havana. So it was an amazing neighborhood, very warm, very very poor but very warm, and the community used to you know, love each other and take care of each other. It was a completely different education. I didn't went to school of music to learn music. I learned my music industry, you know. I never went to school to learn music. Everything I learned, all the music, the folklore I did, I learned was in the street. So it was different, but it was amazing.
I heard that one of your musical mentors was Pancho Quinto. Could you please tell us about him?
Well, Pancho Quinto was the mentor of a lot of percussion players in Cuba from two different generations, you know, my generation and the one before mine. So I was so lucky that I met Pancho when I was very young. His real name was Francisco Hernandez Mora. So when I was very young, I started playing with him on religious purpose, you know. I was playing the music of Santeria, which is how we call it in Cuba, that came from Nigeria, from Africa. And it's the Yoruba religion. So I learned with Pancho a lot about the religion, about the music, and he was one of the greatest percussion players in the folklore side that I met in Cuba.
Your music embodies a mixture of the rumba, jazz, and the spirituality you mentioned. I understand you are also a priest in the Yoruba Santeria religion. Bata drumming is an essential part of your religion and your music. Could you please speak about Bata drumming, what it is, and what role does it play in your music?
Well, you know, the Bata drum came from Africa, from Nigeria, with the slave trade. You know, four different ethnic groups were brought to Cuba, and, you know, the Yoruba people brought the bata to Cuba, and we really appreciate that, because, you know, that's part of, you know, that's a big part of who I am, and I grew up playing bata in Cuba, rumba and all that, so I've been bringing all the Afro-Cuban knowledge that I know and culture and spirituality to my own music. And it's so easy for me to mix it with jazz, because I've been in United States, in New York City. I've been here for over 18 years, so I've been absorbing and learning with a lot of great jazz musicians. I've been playing many records, traveling, performing with a lot of great musicians, but more than the jazz world. Winter Marsalis, Steve Gadd, Steve Touré, Brian Lynch, Eddie Palmieri, many great jazz musicians. So that gave me the opportunity to really exchange knowledge with a lot of jazz musicians and learn a lot from this city.
And speaking of Winton Marsalis, he wrote a piece that was inspired by you and written with you called The Ochus Suite for Jazz Big Band Orchestra and Afro-Cuban Ensemble. The world premiere performance was held at Jazz at Lincoln Center in 2015. You and your musicians performed. What was it like working with Winton Marsalis?
Well, Winton Marsalis is one of my heroes. I can say he's also one of my mentors, because I've been learning a lot from Winton. A lot. You know, he's a great dear friend, one of my favorite people on the whole entire planet. He really impressed me, you know. He never heard about Afro-Cuban music as deep as he did when we started working together for this piece. So he really blew my mind when I gave him everything very, very simple, you know, just the chant and the patterns. And when he bring the charts and what he did, the arrangements, I was like, I couldn't believe it. He's a genius. He's Winton Marsalis. That's all I can say.
He has high esteem for you as well. He describes you as a genius, and he says
that his working with you has been a revelation to him. I listened to the Ocha Suite, and the movements are each named after deities of the Yoruba religion.
Yeah, you know, I was more impressed about him because I grew up with that culture. I grew up listening, playing all the chants and playing all those patterns that you saw in the video. But now Winton didn't grow up with that. So the very first time he got into that was when we got together. I gave him some books to read. I gave him some patterns to learn. And what he did was unbelievable, unreal. You know, it was beautifully amazing.
Wonderful.
I'd like now to highlight your most recent album, Havana Dreams, which was released in June 2016. Can you please tell us about it? I understand it was recorded in Cuba.
Yeah, that record was a dream come true. You know, I take advantage of the relation between the United States and Cuba. It was great that, you know, things got better. So that gave me the opportunity to decide to go with the whole team, with my manager, my group and the record company, Motima, to do the record in Cuba. It was a dream come true. I really reconnect again with my culture, with my friends, old friends, you know, my great musicians that I used to hang with them when I used to live in Cuba. It was a dream come true. It was a beautiful experience. We recorded in one of the most legendary studios in Cuba. The name of the studio was Egrem, Studios Egrem, you know, very, very famous studio from Cuba. So, you know, while we were in the process, a lot of musicians were coming, checking what we were doing, hanging with us. And a lot of, you know, the energy was extraordinary, beautiful, and I enjoyed it a lot. You know, also, it gave me opportunity to invite a lot of great musicians from Cuba. Isa Delgado, one of my favorite singers from Cuba. The Seme Bueno, great singer and songwriter. And Tamari Diaz, also, you know, it was the first time I recorded with my other three brothers. I had three more brothers in Cuba. They are musicians, you know, they are on the record. My another mentor, my godfather in the religion, his name is Roman Diaz. And, you know, Ruben Blades, Winter Marsali. I got great, you know, guests in the record, and I was so, so happy that we did it in Cuba.
I understand Angelique Kidjo was also included on this.
Angelique. Definitely Angelique was on the record, too.
Wonderful. You will be performing at quite a few venues here in New York City in January and beyond. You just gave a performance at Joe's Pub this past weekend.
It was sold out. It was a great show.
Wonderful, wonderful. And coming up, you will be performing at Soup Rosa's on Tuesday, January 18th and Tuesday, January 24th, as part of a residency you've been doing at that venue. And Soup Rosa's is located at 63 Gunzevoort Street in the Meatpacking District in Lower Manhattan. And if our listeners want to learn more about the upcoming performances there, they can go to the Soup Rosa website. And it is S as in Sam, U, B as in boy, R as in Romeo, O, S as in Sam, ANYC.com, ZuprosaNYC.com to learn more about your upcoming performances there on the 18th and the 24th.
Yeah.
And following that, on Friday, the 27th of January, and Saturday, the 28th of January, you will be performing in a collaborative program in the Appel Room at Jazz at Lincoln Center. The title of the program is The Latin Side of Dizzy with Carlos Enriquez. And the program celebrates the Latin influence on the work of Dizzy Gillespie. And should the audience wish to attend that program, they can look at the website of Jazz at Lincoln Center. Another way of finding out about your upcoming performances would be for the audience to take a look at your own website, which is www.pedritomartinezmusic.com. And I'll repeat that. It is www.pedritomartinezmusic.com. And we wish to thank you for your time and for enlightening us about the rich music of your culture.
Thank you, Zitty.
Thank you.
Bye.
Moyuba seda, moyuba koda, moyuba bobo ocha, moyuba bobo richa, moyuba bobo ego. Otuni oba osinita la wache wele che wele mola yoda fuma wo, ache bobo iya locha wawa lochi woro kowa.
I pay tribute to the sun god in the universe, to the stars, to the moon, to Mother Earth, to the sun, and the time is restarts all the deities of the Yoruba pantheon and guides all gods. Tutto la ferola
Iba wawa iba yeye iba seda iba koda iba bobo iya locha baba locha bobo kaleno luo ito la ciencia toko laba lerito kum.
Come fresh, cool water, cool way home, cool kids, and they rest in peace, all religious people in the world beyond. Ache mama, ache yeye, ache olofin, ache olorun, ache olodumare, ache odudua, ache bobo egun, ache obocha, ache oboricha, ache babalocha emi, asienya bi, oniye maya, ache, oyubona kang emi, echu bi okango mwelepa, ache yare mi, ache waware mi, Ache isu boe mi o yala de. Ache. Ache de mi. Ache mo gen kere mi. Iko fafungo obo bekana. Olo batala. Ache. Bobo iya locha. Bawa locha. Ori ate. Bawa lawo. Oluo. Iworo. Lariche. Aleyo. Keko waile. Blessing of all my deceased family, my mother, my father, sun god of the universe, of the stars, of the moon, mother earth, who consecrated me in the religion of my brothers, my wife, and my children, all present, that all good things come to those who initiated me into religion, to my father, my mother, my wife, my children, my siblings, and to all persons who are present.
oldest chant.
So that was the first movement of the Ocha Suite. The name of the movement is Moyuba. And what we heard was the Jazz at Lincoln Center Orchestra, led by Wynton Marsalis, and the beautiful performance of Pedrito Martinez, Ruben Diaz, and third gentleman who were performing with the orchestra. And I had made a slight error in something I said earlier about the dates of these performances at Sabrosas, which are coming up. The date actually is Tuesday, the 17th of January, not the 18th, as I said, and Tuesday, the 24th of January. And you can look at the webpage, which is sabrosanyc.com, to find out more information on the performance. Also on Friday the 27th and Saturday the 28th, Pedrito will be playing on a project called The Latin Side of Dizzy at the Appel Room at Jazz at Lincoln Center. And you can also find out about that by looking at the website for Jazz at Lincoln Center. This was a really quite a beautiful adventure, and I learned a great deal from Pedrito, and his music is quite powerful, and I hope the you listeners will attend one or more of his concerts, and they are quite a lively, spiritual, spirited experience.
And it looks beautiful. We were playing that from the visual. And I tell you, I wanted to start dancing. I wanted to move. I was like, I was already making my way out of the chair. So very beautiful. Thank you, Paulette. We're going to play a few more pieces of music, then we'll transmute or transform ourselves, and we'll come back with a little bit of a reading. So stay tuned. We shall return.
Echado en el abandono, aunque ya has muerto todas mis ilusiones, en vez de maldecirte con justo encono, en mis sueños te colmo, en mis sueños te colmo de bendiciones. Echado en el abandono, aunque ya han muerto todas mis ilusiones, en vez de maldecirte con justo encono, en mis sueños te colmo, en mis sueños te colmo de bendiciones. Sufro la inmensa pena de tu extravío. Siento el dolor profundo de tu partida y lloro sin que sepas que el llanto mío tiene lágrimas negras como mi vida. Quieres dejar, yo no quiero sufrir, contigo me voy mi santo, aunque me cueste el morir.
quieres dejar. Yo no quiero sufrir, pues contigo me voy, mi santo, aunque me cueste morir. Y tú me quieres dejar y yo no quiero sufrir, pero contigo me voy, mi santo, aunque me cueste morir. Tú me quieres dejar, yo no quiero sufrir, contigo me voy, mi santo, aunque me cueste morir.
And that was the Buena Vista Social Club. I love that music. I love it, love it, love it.
That was a great movie, too.
Yes.
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 And that was, what is it? Lagrimas Negras, which you said means black tears.
Yes.
And it was from the, I think, Lost and Found album.
Yes.
Very, very beautiful. And now we are going to move into our serial reading of Ishmael.
Ishmael by Daniel Quinn. To transition from this beautiful Latin music, we go now to the Irish author here. And we finished last time with the established, what's the law? What is something that one never does that the human race thinks that it's exempt from? And how are we doing? So we have what this law that should never be violated that the human race has decided it's exempt from. So Ishmael asks, so what have we discovered here? We've discovered that any species that exempts itself from the rules of competition ends up destroying the community in order to support its own expansion. Any species, including man? Yes, obviously. That's in fact what's happening here. So you see that this, at least this, is not some mysterious wickedness peculiar to the human race. It isn't some imponderable flaw that man that has made the people of your culture the destroyers of the world. No. The same thing would happen with any species, at least with any species strong enough to bring it off, provided that every increase in food supply is answered by an increase in population. Given an expanding food supply, any population will expand. This is true of any species, including the human. The takers have been proving this here for 10,000 years. For 10,000 years, they've been steadily increasing food production to feed an increased population. And every time they've done this, the population has increased still more. I sat there for a minute thinking. Then I said, Mother Culture doesn't agree. Certainly not. I'm sure she disagrees most strenuously. What does she say? She says it's within our power to increase food production without increasing our population. To what end? Why increase food production? To feed the millions who are starving. And as you feed them, Will you extract a promise that they will not reproduce? Well, no, that's not part of the plan. So what will happen if you feed the starving millions? They'll reproduce and our population will increase. Without fail. This is an experiment that has been performed in your culture annually for 10,000 years with completely predictable results. Increasing food production to feed an increased population results in yet another increase in population. Obviously, it has to have this result, and to predict any other is simply to indulge in biological and mathematical fantasies. Even so, I thought some more. Mother Culture says that, if it comes to that, birth control will solve the problem. Yes, if you're ever so foolish as to get into a conversation on this subject with some of your friends, you'll find they have a great sigh of relief when they remember to make this point. Whew! Off the hook. It's like the alcoholic who swears he'll give up drink before it ruins his life. Global population control is always something that's going to happen in the future. It was something that was going to happen in the future when you were 3 billion in 1960. Now, when you're 5 billion, it's still something that's going to happen in the future. True. Nevertheless, it could happen. It could indeed. But not as long as you're enacting this story. As long as you're enacting this story, you will go on answering famine with increased food production. You've seen the ads for sending food to starving people around the world? Yes. Have you ever seen ads for sending contraceptives? No. Never. Mother Culture talks about both sides out of her mouth on this issue. When you say to her population explosion, she replies, global population control. But when you say to her famine, she replies, increased food production. But as it happens, increased food production is an annual event, and global population control is an event that never happens at all. True. Within your culture as a whole, there is in fact no significant thrust toward global population control. The point to see is that there never will be such a thrust so long as you're enacting a story that says the gods made the world for man. For as long as you enact that story, Mother Culture will demand increased food production today and promise population control tomorrow. Yes, I can see that, but I have a question. Proceed. I know what Mother Culture says about famine. What do you say? I say nothing except that your species is not exempt from the biological realities that govern all of the species. But how does that apply to famine? Famine isn't unique to humans. All species are subject to it everywhere in the world. When the population of any species outstrips its food resources, that population declines until it's once again in balance with its resources. Mother Culture says that humans should be exempt from that process. So when she finds a population that has outstripped its resources, she rushes in food from the outside, thus making it a certainty that there will be even more of them to starve in the next generation. Because the population is never allowed to decline to the point at which it can be supported by its own resource, famine becomes a chronic feature of their lives. Yes. A few years ago, I read a story in the paper about an ecologist who made the same point at some conference on hunger. Boy, did he get jumped on. He was practically accused of being a murderer. Yes, I can imagine. His colleagues all over the world understood perfectly well what he was saying. But they have the good sense not to confront Mother Nature with it in the midst of her benevolence. If there are 40,000 people in an area that can only support 30,000, it's no kindness to bring in food from the outside to maintain them at 40,000. That's just guarantee that the famine will continue. True, but at the same time, it's hard just to sit by and let them starve. This is precisely how someone speaks who imagines that he is the world's divinely appointed ruler. I will not let them starve. I will not let the drought come on. I will not let the river flood. It is the gods who let these things, not you. A valid point, I said. Even so, I have one more question on this. Ishmael nodded me on. We increase food production in the U.S. tremendously every year, but our population growth is relatively slight. On the other hand, population growth is steepest in countries with poor agricultural production. This seems to contradict your correlation of food production with population growth. He shook his head in mild disgust. The phenomenon, as it's observed, is this. Every increase in food production to feed an increased population is answered by another increase in population. This says nothing about where the increases occur. I don't get it. An increase in food production in Nebraska doesn't necessarily produce a population increase in Nebraska. It may produce a population increase somewhere in India or Africa. I still don't get it. Every increase in food production is answered by an increase in population somewhere. In other words, someone is consuming Nebraska's surpluses. And if they weren't, Nebraska's farmers would stop producing these surpluses pronto. True, I said, and spent a few moments in thought. Are you suggesting that first world farmers are fueling the third world population explosion? Ultimately, he said, who else is there to fuel it? I sat there staring at him. You need to take a step back from the problem in order to see it in global perspective. At present, there are 5.5 billion of you here, and though millions of you are starving, you're producing enough food to feed 6 billion. And because you're producing enough food for 6 billion, it's a biological certainty that in 3 or 4 years, there will be 6 billion of you. By that time, however, even though millions of you will still be starving, you'll be producing enough food for 6.5 billion, which means that in another 3 or 4 years, there will be 6.5 billion. But by that time, you'll be producing enough food for 7 billion, even though millions of you will still be starving, and which again means that in another 3 or 4 years... there will be 7 billion of you. In order to halt this process, you must face the fact that increasing food production doesn't end your hunger. It only fuels your population explosion. I see that. But how do we stop increasing food production? You do it the same way you stop destroying the ozone layer, the same way you stop cutting down the rainforests. If the will is there, the method will be found. End of subsection 6. 7. As you see, I left a book beside your chair, Ishmael said. It was the American Heritage Book of Indians. While we're on or near the subject of population control, there's a map of tribal location here, there in the front that you may find illuminating. After I'd studied it for a minute, he asked me what I made of it. I didn't realize there were so many different peoples. Not all of them realized there were so many different peoples. Not all of them were here at the same time, but most of them were. What I'd like you to think about is what served to limit their growth. How is the map supposed to help? I want you to see that this was far from an empty continent. Population control wasn't a luxury, it was a necessity. Okay. Any ideas? You mean from looking at the map? No, I'm afraid not. Tell me this. What do the people of your culture do if they get tired of living in the crowded Northeast? That's easy. They move to Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, the wide open spaces. And how do the takers in the world open spaces like that? They don't. They put bumper stickers on their cars that say, "If you love New Mexico, go back to where you came from." But they don't go back. No, they just keep coming. Why can't the takers of these areas stem the flood? Can't they limit the population growth of the Northeast? I don't know. I don't see how they could. So what do you have is a gushing wellspring of growth in one part of the country that no one bothers to turn off because the excess can always flow into the wide open spaces of the West. That's right. Yet each of these states has a boundary. Why don't these boundaries keep them out? Because they're just imaginary lines. Exactly. Trump hasn't built his wall yet. Exactly. All you have to do is transform yourself into an Arizonian to cross that imaginary line and settle down. But the point to note is that around each of the Leva peoples on that map was a boundary that was definitely not imaginary, a cultural boundary. If the Navajo started feeling crowded, they couldn't say to themselves, "Well, the Hopi have a lot of wide open space, let's go over there and be Hopi." Such a thing would have been unthinkable to them. In short, New Yorkers can solve their population problems by becoming Arizonians, but the Navajo couldn't solve the population problem by becoming Hopi. Those cultural boundaries were boundaries that no one crossed by choice. True. On the other hand, the Navajo would cross the Hopi's territorial boundary without crossing their cultural boundary. You mean they could invade Hopi territory? Yes, absolutely. But the point I'm making still stands. If you crossed over into Hopi territory, they didn't give you a form to fill out. They killed you. That worked very well. That gave people a powerful incentive to limit their growth. Yes, there is that. There were not people limiting their growth for the benefit of mankind or for the benefit of the environment. They limited their growth because, for the most part, this was easier than going to war with their neighbors. And, of course, there were some who made no great effort to limit their growth because they had no qualms about going to war with their neighbors. I don't mean to suggest that this was the peaceable kingdom of a utopian dream. In a world where no big brother monitors everyone's behavior and guarantees everyone's property rights, it works very well to have a reputation for fearlessness and ferocity. And you don't acquire such a reputation by sending your neighbors curt notes. You want them to know exactly what they'll be in for if they don't limit their growth and stay in their own territory. Yes, I see. They limit each other. But not just by erecting uncrossable territory boundaries. Their cultural boundaries had to be uncrossable too. The excess population of the Narragansett couldn't just pack up and move out west to be Cheyenne. The Narragansett had to stay where they were and limit their population. Yes, it's another case where diversity seems to work better than homogeneity. End of subsection 7.
Okay, I didn't get that one. I think it's because I'm a little bit peaked, I'm tired. So, Matt, what is the idea of limiting the population? Are you getting it, Paulette?
I think I am. It's about, at least on one level, I see it as a way of control. And when you can limit the population or keep people within certain boundaries, you can then choose amongst them who you will support to lead them and sort of create a scenario for them. The way to, you mentioned earlier, subsidize your food so that what you grow here gets consumed in another part of the world, mm-hmm. is another way of controlling them, because as long as you give them food that's cheaper than they could ever possibly live on for the people who grow that food there, you're actually making them dependent on you. So I can see that. And also concentrating populations like that also creates a labor pool. So there are many aspects of that that have to do with power and hegemony.
Mm-hmm. I kind of understood that part about growing the food in wherever it was, Kansas, and sending it to a third world country, so-called. I wasn't getting the part about the tribes. Do you understand that, Matt?
I think so. You know, if you have a different culture and you have certain ways of doing things, you have certain rules, social interaction, it might be very different from another tribe. You have climate conditions in different regions. That would be a limiting factor. Even a clothing dress, let's say, that you wear, it might be lighter in a warmer climate. And if you cross over into that boundary, you're going to have, nature is going to take care of you. And, you know, you have, like, different cultures interacting and, let's say, inbreeding. It might be a genetic pool, a genetic disturbance there. So it's something like that. if that makes sense.
Well, what it sounds like to me is that basically Ishmael is suggesting that the human race should be subject to the same happenstance of nature as any other living creature on the planet. So if there's drought, creatures die. If there's flood, creatures drown. If there's whatever it is. And so I'm assuming that's what it's saying. Is that what he's suggesting? It kind of reminds me of the story that came earlier in the book where they had a community and they would somehow choose which one to eat.
Right.
In order to keep everyone fed and the population controlled, that nobody really thought about it. They just when it was their turn, it was their turn. In the earlier chapters of Ishmael. So now that same principle seems to be externalized into the natural world, in which, I can understand what's being said. I'm not understanding the point of it, I think. I don't know. Perhaps you have an idea. The number here is 347-335-0818. If you have a thought about what this particular reading of Ishmael, or something that came before it. So I'm kind of getting the gist of the whole thing in that, you know, it's sort of talking about population control and feeding everyone. But what's really interesting is that it's really so much beyond, like you were saying, population control. So, you know, they're subsidizing farmers to make all these products, and so flooding the market with those products.
Well, sometimes they pay the farmers not to produce as well. Yeah. They do that as well.
So it creates a whole scenario and marketplace that's very unnatural. And so therefore, you're creating a situation, as he said, in which people are dependent, as what you said, people are dependent on these unnatural forces. And
I think also, if we really apply what I think part of the message is to what we're seeing now, and what we've seen for a long time, when you talk about immigration and the whole argument that people come over and take jobs that you should be getting and so forth, and here we're talking about the wall that Matt referred
to,
Trump's wall. I think if you combine what economies of the, let's say, the global south go through in terms of taking those subsidies, you know, even when you give someone clothing, you actually prevent their own textile industry from being strong. But by also keeping people within those boundaries, you're condemning those people to live with your subsidies. And not reaching their full potential. And so I think that's a very, very strong statement. People leave their countries for various reasons. Included in that is some of the policies that affect their ability to live and sustain themselves in their home countries. So I think that may be implied in the reading.
Well, also there are many ramifications to this. It's not only farmers growing food, you know, but what kind of food? We have GMOs.
Exactly.
We have pesticides. These are all unnatural things. And these come about because soil, you know, the capitalist system, the way we do it, enough is never enough, and we have to keep getting more and more and more. And when you try to do too much, you minerally deplete the soil.
Sure.
Which is why you need the pesticides. Healthy soil, you grow things that has the nutrients in it that are good for us, that will repel bugs, things like that.
And it's also about monoculture. So rather than growing things that that have a sort of natural rhythm to it, you, I'm just making this up, you can basically insist that a country export corn.
Yeah, well, I understand that, because that's why we're all eating yellow corn as opposed to the way corn was originally made, with multiple colors of yellows and reds and oranges. So I kind of get that part. What I wasn't understanding was this whole part about crossing territories to be, you know, and being killed for crossing territories, tribes and indigenous people crossing one territory into another, and that would be a limiting factor.
Like I in my mind, I see that as the Mexican border. I mean, I shouldn't be laughing because it's not funny, but I see that, I, that whole image of someone crossing over and going through, you know, that stretch of land where people die, mm-hmm. To come and get a better life or to save money to send back to their loved ones. That image comes to mind when you talk about that, crossing mm-hmm. the border and getting shot for crossing the border.
Yeah, yeah. Well, okay, that makes sense. So, all right, so interesting developments in the book, and we'll be continuing with that reading. And Matt, you were reading a little bit from another book you wanted to talk about for briefly.
This is a book entitled Beyond Gurus by a Nancy Cook de Herrera. And this is her whole autobiographical sketch in her involvement in transcendental meditation with Maharishi Mahesh. If you remember, there was the whole thing with the Beatles that got involved, and she was an intimate part of that, setting up the rooms in Rishikesh, India, for when the Beatles came, you know, the Maharishi enlisted her. But there was discussions about, one particular discussion about world peace. So this is just a few paragraphs here. Another example of the power of a strong belief was brought to me in the 80s by Tom Green and Terry Pierce, two successful businessmen in their 40s. We met at a gathering of peace organization leaders in Los Angeles. It was a disappointing meeting, so much ego displayed, but after several hours of exposure to each other, Tom and Terry approached me. We would like 2 days of uninterrupted time with you to present our peace plan. And Nancy is saying, as they were the only ones to impress me at the meeting, they had my attention. Fine, come stay at the house and we'll lock the door and disconnect the phone. Ask your daughter also, she's a clear thinker. It was agreed. The plan they laid out was simple and impressive. We have taken an amateur poll across the state. We find everyone wants peace, but nobody thinks it's possible. So where do we go from there? A person can't even pick up a glass unless he knows it's possible. Then peace is impossible? No. What we need is a massive mind switch. Every idea has its time. That is evolution. We feel the time is now. No small job, but how do you start? We convince the leaders of China, the USA, and Russia that it can be done. Each will think it's his idea, and he will go down in history as the leader who brought peace to this planet. So anyway, to fast forward. The lesson was never say, I am only one person. What can I do to make a difference? So that little blog there, what do you think? Listeners call in. What do you think? Is peace possible? What's the number? 347-335-0818.
It's an interesting topic. Is peace possible? I guess it depends on the scale. I certainly believe peace is possible. I can't tell you how it's going to happen, but I believe it's possible. That number is 347-335-0818. I'm going to play a little bit of music, and as you call in, we'll bring you up for a little dialogue. And you can ask about this question, is peace possible? Or maybe you want to comment on something else, but we only got about 5-6 minutes for you to make that phone call. 347-335-0818.
Time has passed since I've seen your face, and the words that I stood for, you've gently replaced. Deep in your arms, warmed by your smile, I feel your heartbeat, it's whispering, dry your what you want or what you think you need. Let it all go and go with the flow. You can find peace of mind. Breathe deep, set your troubles free.
Was free.
Beautiful.
Beautiful song by Rita Selby from her On Earth CD. And we were talking about borders. And I had mentioned that I find it very odd that everyone is excited about Trump building his wall along the Mexican border. But I was reminded that a lot of companies are going there with their jobs. So it won't be Mexicans trying to get to America. It'll be Americans trying to get into Mexico to get a job. So it'll be reversed in some cases.
Well, he did say today, though, that any company that thinks it's going to close up shop and go to Mexico is going to pay a high tariff to bring its goods in here.
And I got a bridge in Brooklyn I can sell you if you want me to believe that. I don't believe a thing that person says. Because it's all about, he's a gamer, you know, he's a player. And so whatever is popular or whatever he thinks is going to appease, that's what will be said. And it's sort of like a person with multiple personalities. Hmm. And they just keep flipping according to, I don't know what the story is, but I find that the Trump phenomena very curious. And at this stage of the game, I don't really believe anything he says. But, you know, I'm sure it appeased someone. And I also listened to Obama's last speech, which was actually very beautiful. I just kept feeling, well, where were you all this time with this? I mean, he had some beautiful things to say, but I was, it's a shame that he couldn't have said and meant those things for the last 8 years. So that was tragic. But I still have to admit that we're in for some interesting times.
Very much so.
Yet to come. So we're out of time. I want to thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Heart of Mind, Earth at Midnight. I am Catherine Davis with
Paulette Spencer
and
Matt Mazza.
And we'll be back next week at midnight on Wednesday into Thursday morning. So please do tune in again. I'm going to play a little bit more music for you. And I think you might recognize some of it. So let's go for it. And stay tuned for Arrow of the Wolf with Jim Freund.
To learn. coming right on.
Yeah.
Saturday morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and, yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. With me, C.S.E. Cooney, or you can call her Claire, and Carlos Jimenez. Claire Reed, Carlos Jimenez. Stay tuned. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. Okay, I tried. I unfortunately wasn't able to make it to a screening of A Monster Calls this week, but I've been sent a lot of video screeners from publicists, so there has to be something worthy of note in that pile of films that's opening now, right? Well, let's go through a few of them. The interesting thing about Go North is that one of its executive producers is Morgan Spurlock. That may mean that there's an ulterior motive to the fact that this post-apocalyptic teen adventure was shot entirely on location in Detroit. God knows the present-day city that director Matthew Ogens leverages for his near-future scenario is, sadly, all too convincing as a backdrop for the wreckage of civilization. And the scenario he comes up with, in which some unspecified contagion wipes out all adults and the survivors, children and teens, have gathered into a community in which the high school jocks conscript their peers as slave labor, has potential. Unfortunately, Ogens, who also co-scripted, doesn't delve deeply into the dynamics that would result, instead opting for the kind of moony wish-fulfillment fantasy an especially callow teen boy might concoct, in which an equally callow protagonist, played by Jacob Laughlin, convinces the cutest girl in school, played by Sophie Kennedy Clark, to run away with him in search of a vaguely defined refuge from their oppression. They are aided by a benevolent, if not particularly magical, Negro, played by Matthew Love, the best performance in the film, by the way, and confront some decidedly low-stakes life-or-death situations. I frankly think that Lord of the Flies had it right in what would happen if kids were left to fend for themselves. For that matter, the Star Trek episode Miri casts a more convincing Planet of the Kids scenario than what we get with Go North. While we're talking about teenage wastelands, there's also Bad Kids of Crestview Academy. This is a sequel to Bad Kids Go to Hell, a kind of hyperbolic 10 Little Indians meets the Breakfast Club exercise that, for me, was notable for the fact that I can't remember anything notable about it. One of the featured players of that previous film, Ben Browder, takes up the director's chair for this follow-up, which, like the previous film, is based on a series of graphic novels. Browder, of course, is best known for his lead roles in TV shows such as Farscape and Stargate SG-1, and for the comedic spin he likes to bring to such roles. He tries to bring that kind of energy to Crestview Academy, but he's like an Orson Welles with no impulse control. All canted Dutch angles and mismatched color schemes for his cinematography, pointless shifts into comic book-like animation for the murder sequences, Rashomon-style flashbacks that don't much add complexity to the mystery of the suicide or possibly murder of a student as confusion, and characters that can barely raise interest in the audience, much less empathy, including the sister of the victim, played by Sammy Hanratty, who's out to find the murderer by embedding herself with a group of privileged students serving detention in the aftermath of the death. Like the previous film, Bad Kids of Crestview Academy makes nods towards class warfare, but gums it up with sinister conspiracies that make little to no sense. This wasn't much fun, and in a film where most of the male leads are hunks and most of the female leads wear their school uniform blouses tied off at the waist, that's a criminal failure. And then there's Attack of the Lederhosen Zombies. Yes, that's a real film. I've only watched 20 minutes of it. It's set in an Austrian ski resort where some experimental artificial snow solution starts turning people into zombies. It is what it is so far. Enough said. That leaves us with Ocean Waves, which is not a genre film, but is notable for being out of the legendary Japanese animation house Studio Ghibli, for finally getting its U.S. release 24 years after its debut, and for being the first film from the studio not to be directed by Hayao Miyazaki or Isao Takahata. Told in flashbacks, it's the tale of a high school boy, Taku, who tries to contend with the moods and caprices of a particularly difficult girl, Rikako. It's a beautifully observed study of a young man being brought out of his self-involvement into an understanding of the needs and complexities of others. There's some growth, some sweetly humorous moments, a lot of interesting insight into Japanese high school culture circa 1993, and since it's the last film I watched before writing this review segment, it pretty much salvaged my growing fear about what 2017 may hold in store. Ocean Waves is charming, it's honest, it once again reveals that animation can delve surprising depths. For Hour of the Wolf, I'm Dan Persons.
Well, that was shorter than I was expecting, Dan, but that's all right. Last week, he went like 10 minutes, but that was because it was the end of the year show. Now, is my mic even? No, my mic is like barely on. I've got the pot all the way up. Wow, and it's barely on. Wow, I'm practically, shall I say it? No, I won't say it. Horrible, horrible reference I would make to what mics look like and stuff like that, and what it looks like when you're talking too close into a microphone. But forget all that. Let's see. Good morning, everybody. This is Hour of the Wolf. My name is Jim Freund. I really suggest that you come to our reading last night, because it was really good, with Shannon Chakraborty and Fenderson Jelly Clark, and hosted by Rob Cameron, or Cam Robertson, depending on which way he is standing at the moment.
Which is the evil one again?
Both.
Just both. To keep it clear.
Yeah, yeah. Both
that makes it easy, actually.
Absolutely evil. Yeah. He actually was on the show last week, and he read his short story from Clockwork Phoenix 5.
Oh, excellent. The ghost story.
Yes, yes. Really nice story. Say that again.
Oh, it was his excellent ghost story.
It yes, now, but now your mic is on.
Well, that's nice.
Which it wasn't the first time. It's like, I don't know how they wire this room. I'm used to proper consoles instead of mixing boards, but let's not go there, shall we? We're living in an alternate universe. You know, as of last November, it went even more alternate than, or alt-right than anybody can deal with. I can't deal with it, so I just escape. Who am you, anyway? Claire, why don't you introduce the person to your right?
The person to my right is Carlos Alberto Pablo Hernandez, PhD. I call him Dr. Dr. Pants. Yes. Or anything ending in pants.
I didn't know that you had an Alberto. My middle name is Albert.
Oh, look at that. We're practically brothers.
And where they came up with Albert, well, I guess
it means
German.
All, it's Elfbright, right? It's a definitely Germanic, and it's...
Well, I'm, last name is Freund, so that's pretty German, yeah.
And I'm 1/16.